is the third year in a row now when we've taken a Sunday during August to have our celebration out of doors. And insofar as 3 years makes a tradition, it has become a tradition for me on this out-of-doors Sunday afternoon celebration to preach a peacenik sermon. 3 years ago, I kicked off this tradition by telling you about my history with peace sermons. When I was a seminary intern at a large church in New Jersey, we had the first Gulf War. And while I had not yet declared myself a pacifist, I was really worried about that particular war and the United States' involvement in it. And after the ground offensive began in that war, I really needed to go to church and to hear a sermon, any sermon, on the subject of the war. But the pastor at the church where I was working, this large suburban New Jersey church, he said exactly nothing in his sermon that Sunday morning. In fact, while there was a brief mention of the war during the pastoral prayer, a person could have been excused for going to church that morning and thinking that we were a nation at peace. So I promised myself that morning that if ever the United States went to war again, I would preach a sermon on the Sunday after the start of whatever ground offensive there was, which I did in 2003 when we were back at war with Iraq. And I watched a couple of people walk out of the church that morning when I preached an anti-war sermon, when the air was thick with jingoism and pacifism was deemed unpatriotic. But most of the congregation stuck around even after the sermon. And looking back on that sermon, I kind of feel good about the fact that I was one of only 8% of American pastors who even mentioned the war during their sermons that Sunday morning. And the sermon itself was okay. But what I learned is that the sermon was too late. If the first sermon about peace comes after the start of a war, it is too late. So 3 years ago, I decided to preach about peace here at Montclair Presbyterian Church. It was a time when we were still at war in several parts of the world, but there was no new war being waged at that time. And I preached a sermon because I wanted us to be prepared to talk about peace and to practice talking about peace before the next all-out war. And you lovely people of Montclair Presbyterian Church, you actually told me you wanted more than a sermon on peace. And so we started a process that I hope will end with our congregation declaring ourselves to be a peace church, an institution dedicated to the cause of peace. And by way of an update, by the way, let me report that our peacemaking task force has come up with what I think is a really good statement. It took us 2 years of really gratifying work. That statement will be considered by the Peace and Justice Steering Committee at its next meeting. From there, the statement will go to the session and finally to the whole congregation, all of which is a way to say that we are very good Presbyterians here. Years ago, when I promised myself that I would preach a peace sermon at the start of the next war, I started a spiritual process that led me eventually to embrace pacifism. And it's been a good journey, especially since members of this congregation have so wonderfully joined me, helping me to think through what it actually means to be a pacifist. It also has been a surprising journey because 25 years ago, I thought I'd be preaching peace sermons in seasons of conventional warfare, when the U.S. military was inflicting shock and awe, or fire and fury, and quite frankly, power on civilian populations. Well, I confess that I am now a little bit surprised to find myself preaching a peace sermon this year in a world of terror by automobile. In the space of less than a week recently, the world saw two terrorist attacks perpetrated by people driving automobiles. It's something that requires different language to express what, for me, are new ideas. One of the automobiles was in Catalonia, and the so-called Islamic State has claimed responsibility. The other attack, of course, happened in Virginia in the context of last weekend's protests staged by a motley assortment of Nazis and the Ku Klux Klan and sundry fascist and white nationalist groups. Because my thinking around pacifism, for the most part, has been focused on being opposed to the waging of war, I am what you might call a political pacifist. I don't think there can be a moral way to wage war, and in our country anyway, the decision to wage war belongs to politicians. And so as a pastor, I've tried to articulate political reasons not to wage war. But surely, the church must have something to say about the American alt-right, the neo-Nazis and skinheads and Klansmen, and those who fetishize America's racist past, to say nothing of Germany's genocidal fascism from the middle of the last century. Words spoken in response to this hatred won't necessarily be political, because when the Nazis and the KKK show up, we're no longer talking about politics, about left and right, about red and blue. When the conversation turns to the actions of white supremacists, we have left politics, and we have entered into the realm of public morality. And the first thing that I can say about the horrendous racism made manifest in Charlottesville, Virginia a week ago, and that apparently may be coming to the Bay Area next week, the first thing I can say is this. Racism, especially violent racism, is profoundly unchristian. You cannot be a Christian and be a racist. And I'm not just saying this because I grew up among hippies behind the redwood curtain. I'm saying this because nearly 2,000 years ago, the young Christian church made a choice. The Christian church, at its beginning, decided there would be no ethnic or racial barrier to inclusion in the kingdom of God as it is understood and articulated by the church. And as a way of reminding themselves that bigotry was to have no part of the Christian faith, early Christians remembered and retold stories from Jesus' life, many of which presented Jesus' message in inclusive terms. And this evening's lesson is a good example of such a story. In the story, a Canaanite woman comes to Jesus asking him to heal her daughter. And Jesus, expressing a certain amount of nativist bigotry, says no. And he goes on to say, I cannot take food meant for children and give it to the dogs. Now, I love Jesus. I really love Jesus. But that was an awful thing for Jesus to say. Jesus was excluding the Canaanite woman because she wasn't of Jesus' ethnicity. And there's no getting around the fact that he called the little girl a dog, which was a horrible thing to say. It was a serious insult in those days. And the woman, God bless her, wouldn't take no for an answer. She said, oh, come on. The household dogs get to eat as well. And Jesus changed his mind. Thanks to the mother's persistence, Jesus grew in his ability to recognize the humanity of those who were outside of his community. I take that to mean that we all need conversion. We all need to learn. We all need to improve our ability to recognize the humanity of others. Heck, if even Jesus needed a little schooling in bigotry, then so do I. And probably so do you. And the church is meant to be the classroom where this learning takes place. It always has been thus. Now, of course, Christians have done a particularly bad job of learning over the years. We, more than any other religion that I know about, have failed to recognize the humanity of others. We have engaged in genocide, enslavement, ethnic cleansing. We have dismissed whole cultures as evil. We have dismissed whole ethnicities as subhuman. But it does not have to be that way. It should not be that way. We are called by our faith and by the author of our faith to recognize the humanity of every child of God. We are called to do exactly what the so-called alt-right is not doing. And when we recognize the humanity of each child of God, we are doing the work of peacemaking. If I could stand up with the kind of bullhorn that would inspire people actually to listen to what I have to say, I would go to the next alt-right demonstration, probably here in Berkeley, and I would demand the Nazis and skinheads and other racists, I would demand that they recognize the humanity of those who aren't white. And I would do this because I am a Christian. I am part of a religious faith that has, since the very beginning, had ethnic and racial inclusion as part of its design. But you may ask, what about the violence committed by ISIS in Barcelona? Do I have a word of condemnation for that violence? The answer is yes, I do. In fact, I would say to those involved in the Islamic State something surprisingly similar to what I would say to a member of the Ku Klux Klan or to the Nazis. To the white supremacists, I say, be a good Christian. To the member of the Islamic State, I say, be a good Muslim. For while both religious traditions have people in them who have failed at times to live up to the vision of their founders, both religious traditions still call us to aspire to the vision of the founders and not to the failings of the followers. And like Islam, like Christianity, Islam, by design, is a multi-ethnic religious tradition in which there should be no tolerance for prejudice or for racism. Now, an interesting challenge for me personally this week has been conversations I've had about the tactics of the so-called Antifa, which is short for anti-fascists. Sometimes they're also called the Black Bloc. Black Bloc. These are the folks who show up to white supremacist rallies and bring their Molotov cocktails with them. The Nazis and the neo-fascists and the Ku Klux Klan come to places like Berkeley or Charlottesville wanting to provoke a response, and the Antifa are only too happy to oblige them. This last week, I got really sucked into a couple of online arguments about these people. Some of you may have been reading those arguments, I don't know. See, there are a lot of folks, including the President of the United States, who want to suggest that there is no difference between the neo-Nazis and the Antifa, between the alt-right and the anarchist left. And I disagree. Both groups enjoy a good rumble. And by agreeing to be provoked to violence by the white nationalists and sundry racists, the Antifa do us all a big disservice, because sometimes they end up making the bullies look like victims, and that's exactly what the bullies want. They want to look sympathetic. They want to seem like victims of vicious liberals. But the story of Jesus' willingness to be converted by the words of the Canaanite woman reminds me, the story reminds me, that when it comes to issues of race, ideology really matters. What you think of other human beings matters. And there is a big difference between what the Antifa think about humanity and what, say, a Nazi might think about humanity. And I'm pretty sure there are at least 6 million reasons to believe the Nazis and those who sympathize with them are worse than the anti-fascists. And for me, this is personal. I am a straight white male. But not everybody in my family is. I have 2 daughters and a niece who are Chinese immigrants. My family includes folks who are Jewish and Hispanic. and queer. As a pastor, I have served three churches whose congregations reflect the broad diversity that makes humanity beautiful. I have a hard time finding common ground with those who, even with the best of intentions, find moral equivalence between the racists and bigoted right and those who resist them with violence. One side, admittedly without my consent, is using methods I abhor in an attempt to defend people like me and families like mine. The other side would have us marginalized at best, and at worst, they might have us killed for who we are, killed for who we are, killed for who God has created us to be. The differences between the two are big, and they are important. Which isn't to say that I think we should tolerate the violence of the Antifa, but here's what I want. I want everyone, from the President of the United States on down to the two-bit social media provocateurs, to agree without reservation or condition that neo-Nazis, neo-fascists, white nationalists, white supremacists, and the Ku Klux Klan are evil, full stop. This denunciation of racism, bigotry, and xenophobia cannot be compromised by or modified with appeals to the very real fallibilities and venialities of Antifa agitators in the Black Bloc, or by decrying the violence committed on both sides. No. Our common rejection of the so-called alt-right must be firm, decisive, and unambiguous. Now, once we have made a common denunciation of hate, then we can engage in a conversation about how best to address the motley assortment of haters showing up in American cities and promoting vile ideology. I hope we will reject the violent tactics of the anarchist left as being morally questionable and tactically unwise. As a pacifist, I personally will urge my fellow Americans to engage in creative nonviolent protest, preferably making use of artistic satire and great music. Other people may want to march or boycott or block freeways or whatever, but I really hope whatever does not involve vandalism or Molotov cocktails or the harassment of law enforcement officers, most of whom will want nothing more than protect us from the evil speakers and the evil doers. We are on the side of the angels. We need to remember that. If there is a silver lining to the provocations of the white nationalists and the neo-Nazis and the Ku Klux Klan, it is this. The evil of their beliefs should prompt us to examine the ideologies that form our own worldviews. For example, if our sense of patriotism means that we will support our country and its military regardless of what pain and suffering our country and its military inflict upon innocent populations around the world, then we have to ask ourselves if we are honoring the Jesus we meet in this evening's gospel lesson, a Jesus who's willing to change and to recognize the humanity of those who are different. And if the ideologies that define us cause us, in the name of tranquility, to advocate for a status quo in which women and LGBTQ folk and immigrants and non-white Americans must continue to live in a society that denies them equality, then we need to reread this evening's lesson from Matthew and be converted, just as Jesus was converted. If we are going to work for peace, the first thing we have to do is we have to recognize the humanity of those who might otherwise suffer from our disregard. We must act in ways that honor the image of God in each child of God. That might mean we'll have to stand up to bullies. It might mean we have to kneel during the national anthem. It might mean we have to work politically to end war. It might mean we have to change our economic habits so that the choices we make with our money will serve and not hurt those we have come to recognize as human. To recognize the humanity of all God's children, and then to work together in service of that humanity, the humanity we've recognized, this is profoundly Christian work. And it is the work of all people of good faith. And in these troubled times, and may we work tirelessly in the service of God's children everywhere.